At Keeley Companies, it is no secret that they believe in the power of people. In an effort to help their Keeleyans get to know each other a little bit better, they decided to launch the Who Do You Know campaign. The goal was simple. Keeleyans were encouraged to have a conversation with someone outside of their circle. That's it. These conversations, however, have brought people together and furthered their world-class culture. Shout out to the Keeleyans who have made an effort to have meaningful conversations with new friends. You can learn more about those conversations, about those amazing friends, by visiting them online at KeeleyCompanies.com.
Welcome to the Live Inspired podcast with John O'Leary. John is the number one national best-selling author of the book On Fire. He's a world-class inspirational speaker, and he's the host of the Live Inspired podcast. John interviews extraordinary individuals on their life story so that you can wake up from accidental living and more fully live your life story. Here's your host, John O'Leary.
Well, hello, my friends, and welcome to the Live Inspired podcast with John O'Leary. I'm jumping right into this episode because I want to get right into the meat of it. I think it's going to be an episode you're going to love. You're certainly going to love my guest. Her name is Cassie Holmes. She's an award-winning teacher and researcher on time and happiness. She's also the best-selling author of Happier Hour. Happier Hour. Cassie's research examines how focusing on time increases happiness, how the meaning of happiness changes over the course of one's lifetime, and how much happiness people enjoy from extraordinary versus ordinary experiences. During our conversation, Cassie shares her research, including the concept of time poverty. I think it's going to speak to all of us, her own experience as a busy working mother, and the practical tools that we can apply to improve our day-to-day lives. My friends, if you've ever asked yourself, how can I, given the limited amount of time that I have, find greater enjoyment, satisfaction, happiness in my days? Well, this conversation is going to be for you. So grab your favorite Live Inspired journal and pen and drinking beverage and get ready to welcome on my friend and soon to be yours. Her name is Cassie Holmes. Cassie, welcome to Live Inspired with John O'Leary.
Oh, thank you, John, for having me. I'm so excited to talk with you today.
Hey, I'm honored. I feel like I've got a friend already on the podcast. I oftentimes wish that our listeners were tuning in before we hit record, because they would have heard a lot of banter. They would have heard a lot of laughing. They would have heard a little bit of conversation around life and the reason why we do our work in the first place. And they would have heard that I really do respect what you're doing with your profession and the work you are up to today. But for those who you might sit next to on an airplane, and you know, you bump left elbow with their right, and they say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, I'm John O'Leary. What's your name? And you say, I'm Cassie. Cassie, what do you do? How would you respond to that? Cassie, what do you do?
Yeah, I'm a professor, and I would say that I'm a professor of happiness, which is something that sort of, it's funny to say, and when my kids tell folks, you know, what I do, they're like, oh yeah, my mom's a happiness professor. At first, there's like a sort of laugh. It's like, happiness, that this is something serious that one can teach and study. But the answer is yes. And I think it is so serious because it is how we experience our days and the satisfaction we feel about our lives. And I have dedicated my career as a researcher to try to understand what are the decisions that we can make in terms of the time that we spend, in terms of how we think about our time, to feel happier and more fulfilled and more satisfied. And based off of my research, so I'm a professor now, I am at UCLA at the business school, the Anderson School of Business, of Management. And I have spent my whole career at business schools. My PhD was also at a business school at Stanford. And then my first job as a faculty member was at Wharton. So yet another business school. And here I am back in Southern California, teaching now happiness. So having studied it throughout my career, I was like, at some point, no offense to us academics, nobody reads our research other than fellow academics, yet there's so much insight. So about 5 years ago, I was like, I want to teach a course and develop a course so that folks, our MBA students, can learn from the research and design their days and careers and lives for greater satisfaction. And then from that course, seeing the impact that I had, I was like, holy cow, these learnings are having a really wonderful effect. And so when I was approached to write a book, I was like, yes, because I think even more people could benefit from these learnings because not everyone can sit in my 10-week course. So now I'm also an author, I guess, but I really view myself as a researcher on happiness. Hmm.
So I'm going to keep you in California for a little bit. We're not going to go to Pennsylvania. I'm not going to take you all the way to London, I think, where you did some of your studies. We're going to hang out in Southern California for a little bit longer. You grew up in San Diego, yes?
Yes, for the most part.
And I know you moved around a bit. Just walk me through what you were interested in as a child. Because today you come across so happy, so joyful, and so resolute, and not only improving your own level of happiness and impact, but also elevating others. So I'd like to learn a little bit about where that came from.
I would say even as a little girl in San Diego and as a teenager in San Diego, I have been known for my happiness, which sounds like it's like a presentation and an outward thing, but I'm lucky enough to have a natural disposition that is more positive, and I am happy. And I was actually, my mom used to call me Little Miss Happiness when I was little. But the interesting thing is that while I am lucky enough to have a natural disposition that is sort of more positive and cheery, recognizing that not everyone does, and also recognizing that stuff happens. I mean, your story is such an example of that, that life circumstances will come into effect. And the question that I was really interested in is, how can everyone learn what strategies to do, what choices to make, how to think, you know, where to direct their attention and energy so that everyone can feel better? So interesting, when you look at the research, you know, what are those inputs into happiness? Natural disposition does have actually a pretty sizable effect, but we don't have control over that. Circumstances actually have an effect, often a less sizable effect than so many predict, because how we react to and think about those circumstances is what actually translates into how we're feeling in and about our days. But then there's this other big chunk of inputs that is what we intentionally think about and do in the day-to-day that has a significant impact on our happiness. And that's the stuff that we do have control over. And as someone who believes strongly in and wants to believe strongly in our agency, the sense that we have some choice in our experience, that's what I want to figure out. You know, what are those choices that we make? What is that way of thinking? So that those people whose natural disposition is a little more grumpy can maybe apply some of these practices, ways of thinking and behaving, to experience greater joy in their days. And also so that when stuff happens that is not great, what are, again, some of those strategies and ways of thinking and behaving such that people can find happiness again and find joy again and be more resilient and return to a better state more quickly?
Well, obviously, if they're tuning into the Live Inspired podcast, they have an incredible disposition for life already. They're happy all the time and joyful and just, you know, rainbows and unicorns follow them around. And we recognize, you and I and our listeners, that we live with people who aren't like that. And we work with people who aren't like that. And we drive in traffic next to people who aren't like that. And sometimes on our days, we are not people like that. So for those of us who struggle with the disposition of being born a little bit half empty, if you will, little bit less joyful naturally, what are some things that those individuals and we can do to bring a little bit of joy and vibrancy and happiness into our days?
Yeah, I know that you talk about it quite a bit on this podcast. And it's, as I mentioned, it's sort of where you choose to focus, as well as what you spend your time on. And where you choose to focus, I mean, that's where gratitude comes into play. That is, even in those days where things aren't great, there's some silver lining that you can find. And so getting into that practice of focusing, what was the good thing that happened today? What is the good aspect of my life? And actually getting into that practice of directing attention towards the good stuff, towards the half of the glass that is full, right? That practice alone is really effective. Now, in my work, a lot of my focus is on time. So as you asked me, who was I as a high schooler, say, back in San Diego? And then as well as since then, I'm someone who, in addition to being happy, I'm really driven. So I do a lot. And even in looking back, I'm like, oh my gosh, I had no responsibilities. Why did I feel such this pressure to always be doing?
Will you answer that? Because so many folks who listen to podcasts, candidly, are doers. They're the ones who are trying to get happier and trying to make a greater impact and trying to change society for good, one life at a time, trying to have a better marriage, trying to recover after a painful divorce. So these are the doers, and they're the ones raising doers. And there's always a whisper of discontent when you are a perfectionist, when you are a doer. So as you look back on your own childhood with that smile on your face, but also raising your hand to do every single honors class and club level. Why? What's the driver of that in us? And what's the collateral damage in doing it all the time?
Yeah, I think the driver is that we want to do better, prove ourselves, make the world better. And it's so easy to get into that go mode and doing. And I think the bigger question is, what's the collateral damage? Because you can see the benefit of it often very immediately, that you get stuff done, people rely on you, come to you, expect a lot from you. And with those expectations, though, comes more requests and greater expectations for ourselves. The cost is that we feel time poor. And this is what I'm studying a lot now, and actually a big motivator of writing the book. So as I was saying, you know, as a high schooler, I had no responsibilities. But, and then through, you know, my graduate work or undergrad graduate work, I continued to be a doer as an assistant professor, tenure track, continued to be a doer. And it was running. The place that I hit my wall was when I had my first kid. And I share this story in opening the book, and I'll share it because I think it resonates so deeply with a lot of people, of recognizing for us doers that you're not alone. And also the good news, sort of the punchline, is don't worry, there is a way out of it. Again, I was an assistant professor, tenure track at Wharton, living in Philly, and I had my son, and I had agreed when he... to give a talk up in New York, yet he was only 4 months old. So I was still sort of meant to be on maternity leave. But I agreed to give this talk, of course, because I'm a doer. I'm like a yes. And so I traveled up to New York to give this talk. And it was one of these crazy days. My presentation was sandwiched between back-to-back meetings. And I'm rushing from meeting to meeting to my presentation, and then to more meetings, and then this networking sort of colleague dinner. And then frantically rushing, I like looked at the time we were at this dinner, and I was like, I am gonna miss the train. So then I like get in a cab, and as my cheery self, I'm not someone who yells, yet here I am yelling at this cab driver who is already speeding to hurry up and drive faster, because I could not miss this last train that would get me home from New York to Philadelphia. And I did make the train that night, but I remember so vividly, I was like sunk into my seat, absolutely exhausted. And as I was sort of watching the night lights whiz by, I was like, I cannot keep up. This is too much. It is too overwhelming. Between the pressures of my work, wanting to be a good parent, a good partner, a good friend, the never-ending pile of chores, there just simply weren't enough hours in the day to get it all done. And with the doing mode, I wanted to do things well, but I had no way to do everything well. And as someone who is cheery, I wanted to enjoy my life, and I wasn't. And I felt very dissatisfied, unhappy, very stressed out. And I, having worked so hard for a career that I loved, I was like, I don't think I can do this. I need to quit. And something's got to give. And this feeling of time poverty, this having too much to do and not enough time to do it, is very intense and serious. And it is very prevalent now in the work that I research that we're doing now.
As you were sitting on that train, was that a term you were familiar with?
As
you're leaning your head against the glass window, it's kind of cold. You're looking at most of the lights off because people are asleep with their families. Did you know the term time poverty?
I did not.
Tell our audience what it means.
Yeah, it's that acute feeling of having too much to do and not enough time to do it. That feeling I knew all about.
Yeah.
But the term is one that it's in recent years that I've actually started investigating it and trying to understand what is it? And that's the definition of it, but it is subjective. That is the feeling of having too much to do and not enough time to do it. I've examined what are the consequences of it. And what we find is that it has very negative effects and far-reaching effects. From a happiness researcher, we have identified and found evidence, not that anyone needs data to make this point, but it makes us less happy. People who feel time poor are less satisfied in their lives. They feel greater stress. They feel less positive emotion in their days, but it also makes us less nice. When we feel like we don't have enough time, then we're less likely to slow down and help others out. It makes us less healthy. We don't take the time for ourselves to exercise. We don't take the time to eat food that will nourish us as opposed to just sort of get us through the day. It makes us less confident. So we feel like we're just trying to get by and we feel not effective in ourselves. And so all of this is bad. And while I didn't have the data at that point or the academic term to describe it, I knew what it was. And I've since been trying to investigate, okay, what is it? Also, what are its antecedents? That's actually what we're digging into now. What drives, influences these feelings? And most importantly, what can we do about it? So for us doers, it's not like we're going to stop trying to be our best and do our best. How can we, given the time that we have, enjoy greater or find greater enjoyment in our days, find greater satisfaction? And so that at the end of our years, we're not looking back with regret. Mm. And that's what I've been looking to provide answers for in my work and have been sharing in my book and in my course, and I'm living it. And I will say that I am still happy, but now, unlike my high school self, where, you know, it's just relying on natural cheeriness, now I am informed what to be doing when I have one of those days or a year where it's not quite so fun. I have the tools that I'm like, okay, I will practice this and benefit from it.
Awesome. So I want to talk through some of those tools because I know many of us, including the one about to ask the question of you, deals with this sense of being pulled in too many directions and being stressed out and choosing poorly around diet and rest and reaction and everything else we do once we are exhausted and time poor. You've also written, and before I ask you about, so what's the solution? It's important to address the other side of it. If you have all the time in the world to do nothing, to find a desert island and pina coladas and shopping until you drop, and that also makes you miserable. So it's actually finding the sweet spot, not having all the time in the world and no time, but the right time to do the right thing.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up because this is something that we addressed and looked at and investigated in our research in response to the train that night. I was like, something's got to give. I've got to quit. With this idea of like, if I had more time, then I would be happier. If, you know, at that point for me, it was the daydream of like moving to a beach, being some, you know, from San Diego, I like love sunshine and beach. I was like, if I quit and moved to the beach, would I be happier? Thinking that I would. And I think so many people have their sort of little daydream of in those hectic, crazy days of like, oh, I'm just going to give up and like go and have a whole lot more time. Is that associated with greater happiness? And we investigated this with wonderful colleagues of mine, Hal Hirschfield and Marissa Shreef. We investigated what's the relationship between the amount of discretionary time people have and their happiness. And we looked at tons of data, including from the American Times survey. So it captures how tens of thousands of Americans spent a regular day in their lives. And also they measured how satisfied they are with their lives. And from that, we could look at, you know, how much time people were spending on their discretionary activities, that is things that they want to do, versus obligations, things that they have to do. And what we found was this inverted U shape. So sort of like, for those who are listening, it's like a arc or a rainbow. That means that happiness goes down on both ends of the spectrum. We saw that yes, people with too little time were less happy, the time poor amongst us. But the interesting thing was people with too much time were also less happy. And that is cautionary. And the reason that actually in the too little time leads to less happiness because of stress, we know that, right? But the too much time, what we found was that people had this lacking sense of purpose. That is when they had all the hours of their days to spend however they wanted, it undermined their sense of productivity and purpose. And from that, they felt less satisfied. But I will also note in the data, those who spent their discretionary time on what they viewed as purposeful or productive or worthwhile activities, like volunteer work, even though it's not paid work, like engaging in a hobby that's enriching, that felt productive, then you actually didn't see this drop. You also saw that people who spent their discretionary time cultivating their personal relationships, you didn't see this drop. It's not that more and more time led to greater happiness, but you did not see that there's such a thing as too much time. So I bring that up because when people retire or if people do decide to leave their jobs, being thoughtful, it's not like, of course, they're going to be unhappy. It is being really thoughtful about making sure that at least some of the hours in their days are dedicated towards things that feel productive and feel worthwhile, such that it gives that sense of purpose. So all to say, yes, there is such thing as too much time.
Help me find the sweet spot and help us find that sweet spot between overextending ourselves and taking time for, you mentioned hobbies and relationships and walks around the block with the dog and watching the sunrise or set with a loved one and maybe a glass of wine in your right hand. Like, how do you balance in the race through the day? Because I know retirees who feel exhausted by how many responsibilities they have.
Yes.
It's a slower pace, but they feel exhausted. And I know, you know, with some young parents last night, three little kids, man, they are running and gunning. They are wiped out. They are not time affluent right now.
Yes.
How do we find that sweet spot so that we can manage the day as effectively as possible while enjoying the day as massively as possible?
Yeah. And it's an important question. And I will answer it. Before I do, though, just to those parents with young kids and our data with respect to time poverty, they are the most time poor. Folks who are working where your partner is working too with kids under the age of four, they are extreme on feelings of time poverty. But the good news is that once their kids are over four, there's a little bit of tension released. And then also what's a sort of warning or sort of caution is that actually parents who are empty nesters, whose kids are over 18 and out of the house, you actually see that they're some of the folks that get into the too much time situation where, and they actually even feel more like they have more time than folks who never had kids at all. But it's that sort of reference point. So anyway, the parents of young kids, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. But what we find in our work in terms of that sweet spot, what's interesting is actually, except at the extreme, the relationship between how much time people have and their happiness is pretty flat, as in there's no relationship. You see that those who are extremely time poor are less happy. Those who have too much time are less happy. But there's this broad range in between where it's not about how much time you have and your happiness. It's really how you spend your time. And even for those extremes, but this is actually relevant too, because again, it's not about how much time you have. It's really how you spend it, and not just on what activities you spend on, but really whether you're paying attention during those activities. So with those two sort of pieces of the answer to time and happiness, is one is identifying, okay, what are those activities that are worthwhile? And identifying for you, what are those activities that are in line with your values, that are in line with your sense of satisfaction and purpose, and that are fulfilling? And those vary by people. You do see across the research, there are trends. So social connection is so core to our sense of satisfaction and happiness, but it's not like every time you're socializing, it feels very fun and meaningful, right?
Right.
So identifying, okay, what are those times that you're socializing with your friends and family that are ultimately fulfilling, and finding the sources of those. So I have folks do several exercises to identify their happiest activities. One is simple. One is time tracking. Actually, I'll start with the simpler one. Time tracking is a little more detailed. The even simpler one is reflecting back over the last 3 weeks. What were those times that you felt the most joy? And that reflection is a very different question than if I ask, what do you like to do? Because when I ask people, what do you like to do? They're sort of pulling from these general beliefs of like what other people like to do, you know, what they look forward to. But oftentimes, actually, we mispredict our sources of happiness. But reflecting back, you can very easily actually pick up. It's like, oh my gosh, that time that I share this example a lot because it brings me such joy and even talking about it, is like my weekly coffee dates with my daughter, Lita. I go to that quickly. And then I'm also like, oh, actually reflecting back, it's not just these sort of passing sort of social things. It's like, actually that 2 hours last week that I got to work on a research paper, it was like, and actually with no interruptions, close out of emails, don't have any meetings, I'm not, you know, prepping for teaching. It is just digging in to the insights and the data. It's like, that's the good stuff, right? And then we got a new puppy. So like with my husband, as we're out trying to train our puppy, it's very quick and easy to identify, okay, these are sources of joy. What are the activities that I'm doing? So there's a social connection. There's the work that is uninterrupted, that's aligned with my purpose. The exercise and being outside, picking up on these like mood boosters that research supports. And then figuring out, okay, how do I carve out time for that? And it's not a lot of time. The less easy way is time tracking. So I have my students over the course of a week, for each half hour, write down what activity they're doing. And as importantly, rating on a 10-point scale coming out of it, how do they feel? How satisfied, happy? And while it's tedious to track time, it is so insightful because folks at the end of the week can look at their data and be like, okay, what are those activities that I'm giving my highest ratings? And also, what are some commonalities across those happiest activities? And also in that data, you can see just how much time you're spending on your various activities. So for the time poor amongst us, there are some insights that it's like, holy cow, I had no idea I was spending that much time for me. Email. Oh my gosh, talk about something that can fill as much time as I allow it to. Most of it is not necessary. And being very intentional, once you have this sort of insight, what are those activities that are worthwhile? What are those activities that aren't fulfilling? And then you can identify what are the necessary ones, what are the unnecessary ones. So you can reallocate towards the good stuff. And then, so it's like identifying the activities and then given the activities, the good stuff and the bad stuff, how do you make the most of the good stuff? Well, pay attention. And I have a lot of strategies there. How do you make the bad stuff less bad? Well, there's also strategies there. So there's sort of like, you know, different layers to this.
Give me one strategy for each. How do I make the great things even better to really pay attention to those?
Yeah.
And for email or pick it up, the dog poop in the backyard or a million other jobs that you just do, man. You just do this stuff. How do you find joy or happiness in that?
One of the strategies for how to make the good stuff as good as it can be is recognizing that our time, in fact, is limited. And I know that a lot of your work and what you share is really on this point of recognizing time is so critical because it is limited. It is precious. And we don't know how limited our time is, but we do know that it is limited. Like, it is finite. And one of the things is that even something that brings joy, we get used to them. It, like, through hedonic adaptation, this is our psychological tendency to get used to things over time. When you do the same thing again and again, when you're with the same person over and over, that thing stops having as intense of an emotional impact on you. And it's good that we adapt to the bad stuff, right? It makes us resilient. But if that good stuff, just the fact that we're doing it and it's part of the fabric of our lives, that we stop noticing, that's sort of a missed opportunity for happiness that's right there in, you know, the time that you're already spending. And so recognizing that time is limited. And one way you can do that is counting your times left. So with the coffee date with my daughter, I counted. Yeah. And this is an activity that I'm actually having my students do this week of one of these things that is something that brings you joy that you reflected, you know, when you thought of your last 3 weeks. How many times are you going to do that left? I calculated my daughter is now 8. You know, she's going to turn 12 and probably not want to go to the coffee shop with me because she'll want to go with her friends. And so it won't probably be weekly that we get to hang out in this special way. Then she's going to go off to college, you know, and then she's going to move to New York if she's like me or maybe Philly. And so I calculated that we have about 36% of our coffee dates together left. That is much less than half. And she's only 8 years old. And recognizing how limited these activities are in the way that we're currently doing them and that bring us joy, they're not going to last forever. And making that very clear in our minds, what that does is it motivates us to protect the time, to make the time. So it's 30 minutes each week, these coffee days with my daughter. It's only 30 minutes. And again, for the time poor amongst us, it's not like it's requiring 3 hours every day. This is 30 minutes once a week. That has such a big effect. And I protect that 30 minutes because I know it's not going to last. Like, as long as she is willing to hang out with me on these coffee dates, I will not schedule meetings. I will make the time. I will not open my email and then get distracted and think that I don't have time. But also it affects how I'm paying attention. Knowing that it's limited, that sort of hedonic adaptation gets offset, right? I'm like paying attention. I'm soaking it up because we tend to be distracted. And that's actually one of the things. Not only do we not feel like we have time, but in the time that we're spending as doers, we're always thinking about what's next. You know, what should we be doing? What could we be doing? What is next? Which pulls us out of what we're doing right now. But recognizing that those dates are limited, I'm absolutely paying attention. That distractor that we all have, our, you know, smartphones, is put away. And it is time that I'm soaking up and savoring. Recognizing time is limited and counting times left is one strategy to make happy times happier.
How do we make the difficult experiences of the day, whether it's a challenge we're facing in our health or a task we have to do as a parent or as a guardian, a caretaker, an employee, but make that thing that is disruptive to our happiness not only tolerable, but maybe even joyful?
There's two here, both of which are important. One is the easier one, and it's bundling. So bundling is coming out of temptation bundling, coming out of research from one of my favorite colleagues from back in my days at Wharton, Katie Milkman and her team. They looked at it in motivation. So when there's something that you should be doing, like exercise, but not particularly fun, can you bundle it with an activity that you really do want to do, like being able to watch that next episode or listen to that next chapter on a really exciting audiobook? And what they found was that being able to listen to the next chapter on the audiobook motivated people to go to the gym and to run longer because they're listening. But it doesn't just motivate people. It can also make that time more enjoyable. So when you actually look at the time tracking research, the activities that tend to be associated with the least amount of happiness are commuting, actually work hours, as well as doing housework. For the commuting and housework, one of the reasons that they're so onerous is that they feel like a waste of time. It's like something you have to do, but you're just trying to get through it. You're wading through it. But if you bundle it with something that's more enjoyable, then that time itself isn't a waste. It's actually itself worthwhile. Instead of commuting and people sort of mindlessly scrolling through the radio, if they're actually intentional and spending that time listening to a podcast to learn something new or to start listening to audiobooks, all of a sudden that thing, in my time poverty work, I ask people, what don't you have time to do that you wish you did? Reading for pleasure is a very frequent answer. But if every time you get in the car, you listen to an audiobook, then you are reading. Every week you will have read a new book. Or when you're doing chores, actually a reader said that this bundling strategy was one of her favorites because her husband has now taken on ironing as his like favorite Saturday afternoon, because what he does is he sets the ironing board in front of the TV and that's his time to watch sports. And so he has bundled his sports watching with ironing. And this is his now prized and treasured time, which is spent ironing while also watching sports. So the bundling strategy is one way to make some of those sort of chores feel less like a chore. Another, and I think is perhaps even, well, it's harder, but also more important, is for some of those tasks is understanding why you're doing them. I talk, and particularly in the context of work, the importance of understanding one's purpose. What is it that drives you? And I have my students do this exercise, and I describe it in the book of the five whys of like asking you, okay, what do you do for work? And then initially it's the job description. And then I'm like, well, why do you do that? And then your answer to that, it's like, I ask, well, why is that important to you? And in asking these five levels of why, it sort of really illuminates what ultimately drives you. For me, it was so motivating and helpful. So I'm a business school professor. Well, why do I do that? Well, to create and disseminate knowledge. Well, why is that important? Well, I want people to be informed about in the decisions that they make in their days and in their lives. Well, why that? Well, I want them to be happier. And so I recognize that for me, my purpose is to create knowledge about what makes people happy, disseminate knowledge about what makes people happy, and ultimately make people happier. The reason that's helpful is because A, for those tasks that actually aren't in line with that purpose and serve no role, it allows, it gives you the confidence of actually saying no. But even for those tasks that aren't fun, that are in line with that goal, it makes them less painful. So for instance, email, I was saying before, I hate email. But when it's like responding to a collaborator, a research collaborator, I'm like, oh, this is about creating knowledge about what makes people happy. That is, then it feels less onerous to do the email. If it's like responding to a student, I'm like, oh, this is about disseminating knowledge about what makes people happy. So even that task feels less frustrating. It feels less wasteful, which is the thing that drives me nuts, is when I feel like I'm wasting time. It feels less wasteful because I know the why of it. So those are the two strategies, bundling and knowing the why.
So there's several quotes, innumerable quotes that I love from the book, but a couple that I'm going to bring up in front of you now and say, tell me why you said this. Tell me why you wrote this. You teach an executive MBA class. That's context for this quote. If you want a crash course on happiness, take your grandma out to lunch. Tell me why you say that.
Well, because here we are trying to make decisions about what will make our lives feel happy and satisfying. There are people who have done it. They have lived lives that are happy and satisfying, and we can learn from them. One of the assignments that I give my students is to identify someone, an elder whom they respect and admire, who has lived life and is satisfied and happy, and ask them to reflect back. What are their greatest sources of pride? What are their greatest sources of regret? What were those decisions that ended up being more important than they thought, or those decisions that ultimately were less important than they thought? Because we have a lot to learn. And so not only is it informative of like what ultimately matters as we're making decisions about our life, which is how do we spend today's hours, but it's also connecting. And, you know, I talked about the value of social connection, that it's informative as well as really connecting and positive.
So my grandma passed away in 2020, and every lunch I had with her taught me an awful lot about life. So I for those still lucky enough to have their grandmothers around, take them out. You'll both benefit. And I love the idea of taking on someone who models joy, happiness, effectiveness, success in the right sense of the word. Next quote, and then I'm going to ask you one final question, and then we'll shift into what we call the Live Inspired Seven. So the next quote is this: for younger people, extraordinary experiences produce greater happiness than ordinary ones. However, for older people, ordinary experiences produce as much happiness as extraordinary experiences.
Yes. So this is based off of the data. And it's interesting because we do find for younger people, it is those once in a lifetime vacations, going to the concert, the life milestones that produce greater happiness. But what's driving it is because young people view their futures as expansive, as sort of endless. As people get older, they tend to recognize that their time is in fact limited. And then, and from that, they savor more, as I was mentioning before, recognizing time is limited makes us notice the time that we're spending more and enjoy, find that enjoyment in those simple pleasures that are right there in front of them. And what's important to note for young folks is that that joy is available. So when we make younger people recognize their time is limited, they also find incredible happiness in those ordinary moments. And it's not to sort of detract and say extraordinary experiences, you know, are bad. They're wonderful for everyone. But just recognizing that there is happiness too in these things that are much more accessible and available and right there in front of you in the time that you're already spending, if you but pay attention.
What is one thing today that you want our listeners to do so they can become, so they can savor this happier hour? Just give us one next right step.
Is to, having reflected back on a moment that brought them joy, is put a version of that into their calendar for the coming week.
So I'm going to wrap with a personal take on that, and then I'll ask you the Live Inspired 7. My son is a senior in high school now, and the time flew by. So savor, Cassie, those coffee meetings with your cute little date, because it is passing.
Yeah.
I read one of his essays that he wrote to get into a college, and he wrote about the four questions his dad asks him each night. And the questions are, what was the best part of your day? What was the worst part? Where did you experience kindness because someone was nice to you? And where were you kindness because you were nice to them?
Yeah.
So for years now, I've been asking these four questions. And his essay ultimately was, he used to wish dad would just tuck him in and go away. But now as his own time in high school is coming to an end and he's getting ready to launch to college, he's recognizing how much he loved those questions and how he wished he would have spent more time asking the same questions back of his dad. So I think that idea of deciding in your days, where was their joy, will not only allow you to multiply more days like that going forward filled with joy, but to do it with those that you love. It's a great lesson you've encouraged us to do. So the Live Inspired 7 questions begins with question number one. And I know you've read so much, so this will be a difficult one for you, but what's been the most impactful book you've ever read?
I would say back when I was in college, actually. And I mean, if I were to put the thread, it's interesting that I got to where I am in my work, is the Dalai Lama wrote a book, Ethics for New Millennium. In that book, he talks about happiness, but from the Buddhist tradition. But the lessons there are so in line with what I've come to learn in my empirical research.
It's wild how so often the faith and the knowledge of our distant forefathers and mothers is validated ultimately when the research comes alongside of it, right? I mean, you know, this is ancient work that has now been validated through yours and many others. So congratulations on that. What's one positive characteristic, one trait that you possessed as a little girl growing up in Southern California that you wish you exhibited as brilliantly today?
I will say it's not a wishing. I feel very grateful that I sort of continue. I've sort of returned to feeling as that sort of cheery, happy approach to life.
If your home caught fire and your children, your partner, your animals, the puppy dog are all out safely and you have an opportunity of running in and grabbing one item, what's that one thing you would grab?
It's those photographs. Thank gosh that our photos now live digitally, but it's actually, as you're saying, that is a reminder to go for the ones that don't live in the cloud, to take pictures of them so that ultimately I can not have to go back and get anything.
If you could sit on a bench on a gorgeous day and have a long conversation with anyone living nor deceased, who would you like to be seated next to?
I don't know. I've enjoyed our conversation today. It's nice on screen, but it'd be happier in sunshine and on outside on a bench with you.
Well, dude, I'm in LA all the time. So get a big, tall cup of coffee. You will need it if you hang out with O'Leary longer than an hour. But I'll look forward to putting my arm around you on that bench and talking about life. It'll be awesome. Yeah. What's the best advice you've ever received?
Just be yourself.
If you could go back in time to yourself at age 20, what advice would you give her?
Just be yourself. Don't try so hard.
Well, Professor, question number 7 is for you. It has been said that all great people and teachers and moms can have their lives summed up in one sentence. How would you like yours to read?
She made me feel happier.
Professor Cassie Holmes, leader, partner, mom, daughter, friend, teacher. Thank you for helping us feel happier. Thank you for helping us recognize the finiteness within our days and also the sanctity, the beauty within them as well. It's been a pleasure spending this time with you.
It's been a treat. Thank you so much for our time together.
My friends, that is Professor Cassie Holmes. She's the author of Happier Hour. My name is John O'Leary, and today is your day. What a gift. Live inspired. My friend Cassie Holmes today reminded us that time is a finite resource and how we spend it is so important. So I'm going to give you a little bit of homework. I mean, who doesn't love homework coming out of a podcast? So get ready for your homework. You ready for it? All right, kids. Reflect back on a moment that has brought you profound joy in the past week. You got something? Now put a calendar invite on your schedule to do that kind of activity again this week. So I'm going to give you an example. For me, the past week, I had the opportunity of just sitting next to, visiting with, hanging out with my old buddy. I grew up with this guy, share his same last name, first name Jim. He's my older brother. We got to spend some time together over the Easter celebration this past weekend. And I want to do that again the next week. So what I'm going to do is reach out to Jim today to schedule that time. That's how I want to schedule joy on my calendar. What are you going to do? What have you done in the last week that brought you profound joy? And can you multiply that again by doing so again this week? That's the homework assignment. I'm taking my own medicine right now. If you enjoyed today's conversation, you're going to love the conversation I had a couple of years back with Judith Shalovitz. As a society, we've put so much emphasis on work and being busy. In our conversation, though, Judith reminds us of the importance of Sabbath. What Sabbath is and what it means to each of us in our lives, regardless of our faith background, the challenge is to build pause into your week, nourish your community, and be reminded that you are so much more than what you do. It's one of my favorite episodes. Her name is Judith Shalovitz, and you can learn more about that at episode 140 or cruise on over with me right now to johnolearyinspires.com/podcast. We'll have a link to it in the show notes of today's episode. My friends, thank you for being part of our Live Inspired podcast community. Thank you for knowing what I do, that the foundation is firm, that your life is a precious, priceless gift, and that the best is yet to come. So for this time and until next time, my name is John O'Leary. Today is your day. What a gift. Don't waste it. Live inspired. You know that Keeley Companies is all about fostering the world-class culture through their incredible cultural pillars. Well, it was time to add a seventh cultural pillar, Keeley Green. Guided by the mission to raise the sustainability standards by which they design, build, operate, and live, Keeley Green is dedicated to using a holistic approach to leave a positive impact on our environment, create a future that is sustainable for generations to come. In the words of Rusty Keeley, we are just getting started. You can learn more about that just getting started mentality and all the work they do by visiting my friends at Keeley Companies online at keeleycompanies.com.